Today on Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, we've got Dr. Drea Burbank. And I have to say, this is going to be an interesting one. Firefighting, medicine, carbon capture, the climate. You have a hell of a background, Drea. Can you sort of dive in there and take us through?
Yeah, I'll give you the short version. I grew up in a fundamentalist anti-government cult, and I tested into firefighting. I was a forest firefighter for 9 years, went to medical school, decided to fall off the deep end of the world into tech, and currently I'm living in the Colombian Amazon with a fair trade carbon credit company.
Indeed, and with a shaman.
Yeah, this whole idea, my bosses are five shaman. Five indigenous Colombian medicine doctors. They call them Taitos down here. Yeah. They're great bosses.
I got to tell you, that's some crazy stuff. So we've known each other for I mean, it's been like 23 years, I guess.
We were just getting started.
We met when you were a firefighter, right? What's that like? Why did you go into firefighting? Why was that something that was interesting to you?
It wasn't at first. I was just looking for a job, you know, and I was turned 17, and I was part of a low income program for kids whose parents were not well off to get us some money. We were cleaning toilets for the Forest Service. And I had a bet with four of the guys that had come back from a fire, and I said I could do 10 pull-ups, and they said I was a liar. And I did 7, and they called me and said, come work for us fighting fire. But I had no idea what it entailed at first. I just knew it was supposed to pay more than trail building.
Wow. Okay, and then it wasn't, as I understand, it wasn't sort of residential firefighting. I mean, you were in forests and whatnot, right? Like giant, massive acre and hectare blazes.
Yeah, I'm going to sound like a dick here, but forest firefighters make fun of structural firefighters, as do paramedics, as do policemen, because forest firefighting is a completely different job. It's you're dealing with out of control external fire rather than kind of a controlled internal blaze. The technology is totally different. The job is completely, you know, the professional requirements are completely different. Like a structure firefighter has to be a pillar of the community, show up on calendars, fundraising, that kind of thing. A structure firefighter or a forest firefighter is often ex-military, ex-convict, a totally different woodsman, totally different group of people. I did gang intervention for a while with forest firefighting. It's a great way to rebuild your life if you've got a good work ethic. And you're trying to kind of like find a traditional job that's not going to question your background.
Whoa. I mean, I'm kind of in shock here. So why does someone like yourself decide that this is the right thing for them up front? I mean, you said you just needed a job, but you stuck with it for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, I think initially, so I grew up off the grid. I didn't have any education, and I tested into university at 18, but there was no resources. Like, the women in my situation were encouraged to follow a completely different life course, and it did not involve education, even a GED, for a lot of my peer group. So I had no funding whatsoever to go to university, and I knew it would pay enough, and it was during the summers. So I stuck with it for that reason initially. I don't think I was anywhere near prepared for the societal change that it would have involved. I tell people I was raised by fundamentalists and firefighters, and they cancel each other out, but really it was just two completely different perspectives on the world. When I started doing it, though, I fell in love with fire. Like, if you really stick with fire a long time, you're basically a pyromaniac, and I ended up chasing it into the hot shots. I was a hot shot in LA for 3 years, and when you're doing that kind of work, at the time, it was the second most dangerous job in the world, so the adrenaline was just addictive.
I believe that. You said you ended up chasing into hot shots?
Yeah, hot shots are 20-man crews. A lot of people know about smoke jumpers. So smoke jumpers parachute in, and they're oftentimes singly or in groups of three. Hot shots, in contrast, is a very organized work group. They borrow a lot of tools and stuff from the U.S. military. And you're in a very structured work group. You hike. You work for 16-hour days, 14 to 21 days at a time. And then you get a day off to 2 days off, and then you go back to fighting fire. And we would only hit complex fires. So we would go for the first 3 days of an out-of-control blaze in Oregon, the next 3 days in Arizona, We went to Hawaii, fought a volcano fire. Like, it was just for somebody in their 20s, quick cash, easy money, hard work. I think the issue for me was that I was oftentimes the only woman, up to 1,000 men in fire camp. And so that was the hard part, I think, for me.
Okay. I can imagine what kind of things, sort of, you know, technologies and whatnot do they use to, I don't know, identify, contain, you know, the these massive forest fires and then ultimately eliminate. I mean, you know, for the rest of us, we're mostly thinking water, right? Water and maybe some foam or whatever, or I don't know. I mean, how does this work?
Dirt and strategy.
Really?
So yeah, if you really control a fire, I mean, you just can't put enough water on a forest fire to put it out. Like, the seasons will put it out eventually, but even wintertime won't always suppress a fire. Fire is addictive because once you really get a sense for it, it has this absolute natural beauty. So fire runs uphill the way water runs downhill. And once you understand that and you understand topography and terrain, and if you have a kinesthetic sense of the woods the way that I do, you get a sense for where the fire is going to go. And what you do is you kind of creep around the edges by digging ditches in the dirt and separating the burnt stuff from the not burnt stuff. And then you slowly contain it, but you have to always stay behind it. You're always trailing it. If you get in front of it, you die. And then sometimes it'll switch course suddenly. So fire will do strange and beautiful things. Like, it'll create a thundercloud of its own big enough to create a lightning strike that creates another fire. It'll run downhill. Yeah.
Say that again. You just said that fire can create a rain cloud that ultimately gathers what? I guess enough static electricity that it literally can create a bolt of lightning that can create another fire. You're kidding.
Yeah, that happened on one of the fires I worked on later in 2003. And then we would sometimes work for like 14 days at a time and then see the neighboring fire come and overrun when we were working. So you get this really interesting sense of the combination between hard work. So you're literally swinging a pickaxe for 14 hours a day. And, you know, you hike for like 3 to 4 hours that day up very steep. I mean, firefighters just go straight up. We don't do switchbacks. And then you're carrying a 40-pound pack, and then you're working in the heat, and then you're swinging a pickaxe. And so you're really, really working. Like, it's manual labor in some of the most inhospitable terrain known to man. And then also you get a sense for like what you can't control. So the fire is completely outside of your control. So you have this combination of like, my backbreaking labor day in and day out for weeks at a time will control this completely uncontrollable thing. And that is, it's beautiful once you really get a sense for it.
I mean, I can see how you got, I'm not sure it's for me, but I can see how you get there. That's incredible. So, in sort of doing this, I imagine you met some interesting folks and whatnot. But continuing, you sort of mentioned dirt, you mentioned, digging ditches. What are some of the other sort of tactics and strategies that I don't know, that escape the rest of us for like, what are some of the things that are sort of misunderstood about this field? Again, I mean, I just mentioned water and you're like, yeah, that's not really a thing in forest firefighters. I'm like, okay, cool. Like, what are some other things that we could, you know, we sort of either take for granted or just, you know, myths?
Well, you do use water, you use pumps and hoses, and there's aerial drops from helicopters and all that. But it's just especially in the California where the fire is super hot and the weather is really dry, the amount of water you'd have to borrow from the town's water supply. So it's very strategic when you do and don't use water. One thing that is beautiful about forest fires that only somebody who fought them would know is something called coal trailing. And after you initially control the fire, so you're in a desert and even a spark will start it up again. And so you have to go in with your hands on the edge of the blaze and you crawl in the black and the dirt and you feel every single edge in the soot looking for hot spots. And then sometimes you'll have to, like, you know, in Idaho where the trees get really deep, I was on a fire once for a month after it had been put out, and you would still see, like, a month later, a stump would suddenly catch fire and start smoking. So you have to go in there and you would hunt and you would, like, dig and dig and dig and dig and dig and dig an entire, like, you would uproot an entire tree to get down to the tiny little ember at the bottom. So those are, like, quiet times, and they're filthy. You're covered in soot from head to toe. But it's this kind of, like, hunt for the last little ember that's also kind of fun.
Wow. I didn't realize. And did you say up to like a month that it can reignite?
Yep, it'll come up. Wow. And it's not uncommon. You'll see this all the time. Like a fire was put out and then all of a sudden the fire will pop up again. In fact, it's some of the most dangerous time because what will happen is the really hot blaze will go through and it'll dry everything out. And then you'll have crews in there later going to clean up and you can have like these isolated chimneys or canyons just go off really quickly. And that a lot of people die on already controlled fires.
Did you ever have any close calls out there?
Yes, I did. More than one. I think one of the reasons I got out mostly is the toll on my large joints. So most of my crew was like 6 feet tall. I'm 5'4". They were all men. I was a woman. If you do the same amount of work as they do, it just takes a bigger toll on your joints. It's simple physics. So I started to feel like my large joints aching a lot. And that sucked because I could feel like, I guess it's like an athlete, you know, at a certain point you realize you've reached the limit and you can either beat your body up or you can move on to a different sport. My next sport was climbing, but we'll talk about that later. Anyway, what was the question? I got distracted.
That's all right. We were talking about close calls.
Yeah. Okay. We got struck by lightning. This should have been like readily apparent to us. We were on a lightning fire at the top of a peak in like a huge plain in Arizona. And, I remember we were on this peak and we heard thunder 2 miles away. And one of the guys standing next to me held his tool up in the air and he goes, "Strike me now, God." we all started screaming at him. We're like, "Get on the ground." And about 10 minutes later, or not even, sorry, it was probably 10 seconds later, we heard this sound like God's like had just like rained hell on us. And 4 of the guys got blasted off the rock they were sitting on. So struck by lightning, and then it was God's version of a thunderstorm. I've never been so in awe of like hell breaking loose around me as I was at that moment. So it lasted for about 20 minutes, and they had heart palpitations and stuff. So that was number one. And then I was on a night fire, and there was a constant threat of burning to death. It was nonstop. It was ever present, and it was all we thought about all the time. In this particular case, a burning snag fell like on top of me. And I went to go run, but I ran right into a wall of brush. And so I was pinioned there like a fly in a spider web. And I just looked over my shoulder and the tree fell within probably inches of me. And I just had this like intense feeling that my number was up. It was the first time I ever experienced PTSD. It was mild version, but I certainly had it.
I would imagine. I mean, who wouldn't during that time? Did everybody make it out okay, I hope?
In both cases, we did. Our crew was pretty lucky. I think right after we quit, another crew got vaporized. It was about 20 people, and there's movies and stuff about it. But it was routine in the forest that I was on for in the 70s. People, 20-man crews that go up and smoke, not infrequently. They really got a better handle on it, and that's one thing I love about firefighting is the Forest Service really sat down and looked at it, and they started this system called near-miss reporting. So if you had something that almost killed you, you would tell the entire nation about it. And it's embarrassing. A lot of people didn't want to do it. And I wish they did it in medicine.
Yeah. you're talking about this stuff so nonchalantly as if it's just part of, I mean, it is just part of who you are. Don't get me wrong. But wow. I mean, it's pretty incredible stuff.
I think living with an ever-present awareness of death is one of the best things you could ever do in your life. Especially if you spend a significant amount of time like it.
Why do you think that?
Well, in Zen Buddhism, they call it memento mori, remember you must die. It's the only task all of us have in front of us, no matter how much we like to forget it. And living with it for a significant period of time makes you so vastly aware of living. Like every day is a gift, and every day is sweet, and you really never forget it. It just completely changes the way that you see the rest of your life.
Okay, that's fair. Do you have other tales of firefighting that you wanted to bring up here? The only reason I'm asking is, again, I'm kind of enamored with these stories. But specifically, going through these firefighting tales, do we have specific instances and scenarios where basically your knowledge of you know science and technology sort of was paramount?
Yeah. Okay. I'll tell you one. We had these tiny little aluminum foil weather kits, they probably made like 2 ounces, and it was the most simple technology ever. It was like a little aluminum foil thing, and you would put it, it was a wick, and you put it on the end of a string and you would spin it. And then the speed with which it evaporated would tell you how much relative humidity was in the air. And my job on the crew, when it got bad every 15 minutes, was to take a weather reading. And the only people I know who are so in tune with wind are the sailors, that have such a fine sense of wind and where it's at. Wildland fire in the desert and sailors. Even a gust of a breeze, and we know where the wind is coming from and where it's going to go and when it's going to pick up speed, because desert fires and grass fires are all wind-driven fires. So every 15 minutes, I would take this tiny little flimsy technology out of my bag, and our lives would depend on it. And I remember vividly one day, like, taking a reading, and we were down in the 4% relative humidity, and it was 110 degrees. Then that was not uncommon during the summer. And my boss kind of did this and held us back, and we all sat down on the dirt and we watched the hill in front of us vaporize. It was about 2 miles from bottom to top, and it went up in smoke in about 2 minutes. So wow. I got this very kinesthetic sense for science and your readings and how it can save your life or not. And then that responsibility, I remember, was super intense, because you had to kind of like step out of line, and you weren't working. Everybody else would be working and you'd be doing your little reading. And there was a little bit of sense of like isolation, like, why am I standing here waving this thing in the air when everybody else is working? But our lives depended on it.
So is this sort of sense of mortality, and for that matter, you know, saving people's lives, is that something that drove you into medicine?
No, I'm positive that I went into medicine. Well, I went into it for 2 reasons. When I realized that I couldn't keep fighting for air for the rest of my life, like, I really did want to at the time. I went through the phone book. I was a ski bum that winter in Golden, British Columbia. So I was learning how to snowboard. It's a ski hill that's 90% black diamond, and they would bomb it every morning with avalanche bombs. So I'm sitting in this town, and I finally got my work visa in Canada, and I went through the phone book in this town because I was like, I like this town. This is a great town. I'm gonna stay here forever. And obviously I didn't, but at the time I thought I would. And I found 2 jobs that I thought I could do. And one was doctor and one was a college professor, like a community college professor. And I chose doctor because I thought it would be less politics. I knew nobody who was a doctor. I rarely had an encounter with a doctor because I grew up so poor we couldn't afford to go to the doctor. And so it was all just kind of lay people that like kind of did healings in their house and stuff and patched you back together. Yeah. And I had no idea what I was signing up for. Not at all. I just thought it would be a good job. I did read Aerosmith when I was 13. And so that was my main motivation, or like exposure to a medical career in advance.
What did you read when you were 13?
Aerosmith by Sinclair Lewis. I still think it's the best novel about being a doctor ever.
I thought you were talking about the 70s band.
Apparently, it's like a quintessential doctor or novel. And a lot of people have read Sinclair Lewis for other reasons, but I still think that he wrote the best book about being a Western physician that was ever written.
Okay. So that might have been the seminal point early on that sort of kicked this off eventually later in your life.
I might have been subconscious. I don't know. I knew that I was smart, but I had very little formal education. And I had a non-traditional intellect, and I knew that early on. So, and it's not like anybody ever sat me down and said, women should be smart and go to school. Like, everybody always told me women should have babies and not get a GED. And be a good support to their husband, who will be their religious leader their entire lives. And I rejected that early on, but I didn't really have an alternative worldview to put in its place. So,
I mean, you certainly blew that stereotype out of the water.
Yeah, somewhat intentionally. I think there's something that people say about Catholic schoolgirl syndrome, and it's true. Like, when you grow up with a very oppressive religious kind of background, it's hard not to identify yourself as its reverse. And I think I was aware of that early in my 20s, and I worked really hard to achieve a more balanced worldview.
Good. That sounds great. So then you went to medical school. You became a doctor.
Yep.
What kind of doctor?
I like that that's 2 sentences. It's like 12 years of my life in backbreaking work. And at the same time, in retrospect, it seems such a waste of time. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was one of the only people in medical school who was like, I don't know what I want to do. And I was so stuck on it. I think I was stuck between emergency physician and plastic surgery. And I didn't expect I would like plastic surgery, but as a kid, I did a ton of taxidermy. In fact, my first job was for a taxidermist, and I was actually really, really, really good at dissections. And I didn't have any sense of what that would factor into in a later career, but plastic surgery was the closest to that competency. I also did a ton of embroidery. So with the two, I just had a natural sense of my hands. And plastics is the most beautiful form of surgery by far. So yeah, I loved microsurgery. And then I liked the adrenaline of emergency medicine. I went to paramedic school first to get a sense for patients, because I felt like too many people became doctors without knowing if they liked patients. So I wanted to find out if I even liked just the pattern of seeing people hurt and whether I felt disgust or compassion. I wanted to know that. I wish they did two things. I wish they gave all doctors functional MRI to see if they had empathy. And I wish that they made them treat patients before they went to medical school.
Do you think that there's a number of doctors without functional empathy? Do you think that's a real thing? And if it is, the follow-up question is, which discipline do you think they go into the most?
I have no doubt. There is probably, I would say, estimate 20% of doctors lack significant empathy. And if they don't lack it before training, they do their best to shut it off during training. It's a painful way to practice. And then the, by all self-reports among doctors, neurosurgery is the best place for a sociopath. Patients do the poorest, and having lack of concern for outcomes makes you a better surgeon in neurosurgery.
Okay. I guess that's good to know.
Yeah, I mean, you still don't. I mean, I actually, if I had to get brain surgery, I probably wouldn't care if my doctor was a sociopath or not, because neurosurgeons are driven more by competition with their peers. And you can still be an amazing neurosurgeon and have absolutely no functional empathy.
I guess at that point, when you're having brain surgery, it's kind of irrelevant what the person is. It's more just wanting the outcome to be positive, right?
Yeah, and honestly, neurosurgery outcomes are almost universally negative. So empathy just makes you burn out faster. So some of the better surgeons just don't feel any kind of empathy for their patients. A lot of Western doctors will tell you that empathy is a disability.
Well, let's go the other direction. What would you say? Not trying to play off what you just said, but I'll ask it anyway. What kind of doctor would you think would have the most empathy?
It's not pediatricians like you would think, because actually pediatrics is pretty damn tough. Kids get sick
and they
die.
That's what jumped to the top of my head at first.
I find palliative care docs can be incredibly empathetic, and internal medicine doctors are just big. They're just big, nerdy, bleeding hearts. Like, if you want to find your ultimate like doctor soul, find an internal medicine doc. Because there's no reason to go internal medicine unless you love medicine, love patients, and want to get your ass kicked to save the world. Like,
okay.
Actually, eMERGE docs can be just astoundingly empathetic, and you would not expect it because they see so much trauma. But they are the people who seem to be the most broken in by their practice.
Why do you think that
broken
is?
Broken open. I think it's interfacing on the border of life and death, and then the combination of triviality. Like, they deal with so much triviality. They also deal with a ton of social work issues, just as a routine, and then just extreme trauma. So, you know, you'll go from somebody complaining about a hangnail for no reason and taking up a spot in the ER and demanding opiates for it to, a child that got, that's going to die from a wreck. And, sure. And you have to go... You have to switch into that mode immediately. And something about it, I don't know. I always, eMERGE docs are some of my favorite people.
Okay. Similar question to the firefighting one. What's something we take for granted about plastics that is just either not true or misunderstood?
Plastics is the strangest specialty I've ever been involved with. It attracts people who are straight up sociopathic and just want to make money and do cosmetic surgery. And it also attracts the strongest surgical nerds, the people who just love surgery, think it's the most beautiful thing we've ever seen, and want to master it with, you know, true ardent dedication to the craft. And a lot of plastic surgeons won't do cosmetic surgery. So you have to do it in training, but a lot of plastic surgeons make less money than other surgeons. They do hand surgery or reconstructive wounds, and they lose money. Also, one thing people don't know about plastics is that yes, you will do boobs and noses and stuff if you're in training, but also they deal with all the complex wounds. If somebody botches a surgery, it goes to a plastic surgeon.
Okay, so a lot of time they're doing cleanups.
Yeah, if a wound never heals, it'll go to a plastic surgeon. Like I worked at Stanford's wound healing clinic, and it's almost like a forest fire, I will say. You have this like intense devastation that seems like you'll never get ahead of, and you're just like carefully and labor intensively, slowly cleaning and cleaning and cleaning, and it will heal. You can heal almost anything.
Wow. Okay. Inside of plastics, what are some of the newest sort of things that are out there? I mean, these days we've got lasers, and there's these incredible microsurgeries, et cetera. What does that look like in the plastics field today versus, let's say, I don't know, even 20 years ago, even like the beginning of the 2000s versus where we're at right this second? What technological advances have been made?
Yeah, that's what interested me to plastics in the first place, I think, is anything new, any new technology in surgery almost always enters through plastics. And the reason is that they're the surgical nerds. So they are the ones who are willing to take the time on an operation or with an experimental therapy to try it out. With cosmetic surgery, there's sometimes more money involved in order to like bring something new in. And tissue transfer is one of the most beautiful operations I've ever seen. I worked at the Bunky Clinic for a while where they were replanting hands, and that can be really interesting. They'll take an unnecessary muscle from one part of the body and move it to another. And if you ever want to see like true surgical nerd, the Bunky Clinic has a website where they describe each of those operations in the most like simplistic and beautiful detail. Everybody in the world studies their website.
So were you involved with I would imagine you mentioned two different types of people who are specifically attracted to this. One of them was the sociopath, and the other one is someone who just enjoys the beauty of medicine. Knowing you, I'm guessing you're the latter.
I was a nerd.
So in that particular case, have you exactly? So have you sort of done some of these surgeries where you're either reconstructing hands or various parts or cleaning up surgeries? Like, has that been something you've been involved in? And did any of them stick out to you?
Yeah, I think I've done just about every plastics case there is out there, but only as an assist or an observer. Yes, the one that I love the most, absolutely bar none, and this is the one that kicked me out of medicine, surprisingly. There is a surgeon in Alberta that was pioneering the use of external nerve stimulus. So you could implant an electrode on a nerve, and then you would put a transmitter on the ear, and you could take somebody with a paralyzed hand and they would click their teeth, and it would open and close their hand. And you would totally skip the brain and all the nerves, and you would just stimulate the peripheral nerve remotely. And I had this vision that you could restore motor function in paraplegics. I mean, with enough stimulus and a complex enough computer program, you could put the electrodes on the peripheral nerves and literally restore walking in somebody who was completely paralyzed. And I was obsessed with this idea, and I thought that I would leave medicine for a year between medical school and residency, and I would gain enough computer knowledge to make this happen. And what I discovered was that wasn't possible. Like, the minute I stepped off the train track of medicine, I missed the train and it was over. And it was gone so quickly that I never anticipated it would be like that. But medicine is completely unforgiving to exploration of technology, which I learned when I tried to come back.
So what's stopping us from doing that? I mean, that sounds like an incredible project. What stops us from having that being the case? Is it the code? Is it the electrical engineering just won't work out? Is it too complex? I mean, what's the issue?
I wish I could simplify it. And there might be trauma in this, because when I lost medicine, it was a blow that I didn't anticipate being so painful, especially when I lost my chance at plastics. And I grieved it for a long time. But I think what it is good things in medicine are about 80 years old. So laparoscopic surgery took 80 years to penetrate into surgery. The the penicillin was 50 years. The gap between when something is developed and when it's considered safe to apply to patients is long, and that's never going to change, I don't think. The human body evolved over like 5,000 years, and every doctor's been involved in experimental stuff that was botched or hurt the patient. And the Hippocratic Oath is pretty unforgiving in that sense. Like, it's better to not act. And that is the decision of the entire profession, and it's the thing you take. It's the oath you take on day one, and you never forget it, which is that it's better never to do harm. And so what that means is medicine is totally loath to introduce new treatments or new therapies, and often with good reason. Doctors are the gatekeepers for this stuff. And a lot of the stuff people think they want to do, like implanting brain stimulus that gives you an artificial reality overlay on your eye, I mean, it would just infect the brain. And like, you would have to treat the body for a long time to realize how much of healing is dependent on the body's internal structures and how intelligent the body really is, and how staying out of its way is probably the best thing you could do as a doctor in most cases. So doctors learn, and good doctors really learn this. They learn to work with what the body already does rather than trying to replace it or impose an external will on it.
Yeah. So in that sense, I mean, you kind of just brought it up, but like, I'm guessing you don't think Elon Musk's Neuralink is a particularly good idea.
If Elon Musk had ever cleaned out an infected brain, he would never even think about that. If he'd ever seen what happens to anything artificial implanted in the human body after 5 years, the body scars around it. It attempts to expel it. It'll the body will systematically extrude anything. Like, if you leave a screw in a bone after a surgery, and that even just leaving one screw in a bone is oftentimes the surgeon will agonize over it, because sometimes the bone will completely reject the screw, and the body over 5 years will attempt to push that screw out. The idea that you would put an electronic implant into a human brain and that the body would simply accept it is horrific to anybody who truly understands the body and the immune system.
Okay. So in order to actually create something like that, I'm spitballing, but in order to create something like that, it would almost have to be biological in nature, right? Like, it almost couldn't be electronic. It would almost have to find something that the body would actually accept and then effectively create for some definition of computer, a computational device using basically biologics. Is that a reasonable supposition?
You could think about that, but I work with xenografts in plastic surgery. So you take like pig from a
sorry, you worked
skin
with...
from a pig. So sorry, okay. There's allografts, which is like from your own body. Autografts are from your own body. Allografts are from somebody else's, like a cadaver's. And then xenografts are from an animal. So you could take like a biological species, like a pig or something, and you can clean out all of the markers that make the body react to it and put it in. But a lot of times what will happen is when you take these external tissues and put them into the body will kind of degrade it. The tissue will lose its characteristic form. I work with tissue engineering for a while, and it's very, very hard to take an external biological substance, put it in the body, and not expect the body to kind of like morph it. So
there's
much about life we don't understand.
That's fair. That's definitely fair. So what caused you to leave medicine? You mentioned this a little bit earlier, and I know there's a little bit of a story here. What caused you to leave?
Well, two things. First off, I missed my shot. Like, after I'd taken, I tried to take 1 year at Stanford doing a biomedical informatics program, and I ended up in a different program instead. And it was 3 years before I went back. So I launched a telemedicine platform around the U.S. It was in 2014. We had 60,000 doctors, and we had specialty and primary care consults for $30 outside of insurance. And that was fun. And I thought that would be like appealing to doctors. But when I went back to make residency applications, I was universally rejected, not just 1 year, in all of North America, 3 years in a row. I finally made it into a very bottom of the barrel residency, which was my version of hell on earth. I think they call it vicarious trauma when your external circumstances and the expectations around you force you to do things that are outside of your moral code. And I had an idyllic training situation. I worked with some of the best physicians in one of the best hospitals in the world. I still think Canada and rural medicine is some of the most beautiful clinical care I've ever seen. And to work in a like bottom of the barrel, like industrial residency where patients were routinely hurt through action or inaction was too painful, and I ended up leaving. And I think that's okay. At the end of the day, I've looked at my career and my training and my mind, and I've realized that I was probably not suited well for medicine. Good doctors do the same thing every day. Like a good doctor, a really good doctor, doesn't change their care. They're very much doing the same thing, and the thing has been done for 80 years, and they're conformists, they're intellectual conformists. The more curious, experimental, innovative you are, the worse of a time you'll have in Western medicine. And I wish I'd understood that when I went in, but I don't think I really knew that about my own brain before I went through that kind of like intense training.
Okay. You kind of mentioned you were universally rejected. Do you think the telemedicine thing was the cause of that? What was the impetus behind that?
I think it's a combination of like, why did I take time off? Usually when doctors take time off after medicine, it's because they did something wrong. So they made a mistake in clinical training, and they weren't allowed to match the residency. I hadn't done anything wrong, but nobody would believe that because it was just me saying it. And then the second thing was just my focus on technology. Most of the residency programs are they're interested in conformity and that a resident will follow the rules and that they won't leave mid-training. And the idea is that if you go do technology, you have seen the other side of the world, you're just going to run away anyway. You're not going to put up with the trauma training. And I tend to agree, actually. After I finally did land my residency, I realized that I had absolutely no interest whatsoever in living that kind of a life.
Drea, what caused you to leave medicine? You kind of mentioned that a little bit earlier, and then we sort of talked through some of that, and then we ended up going. You ended up mentioning that you were sort of universally almost rejected from these residency. What was the cause there? What was the impetus and driving force behind that?
I think I've already mentioned that doctors have an aversion to emerging technology, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. In our generation, the experience of being a Western doctor is significantly corroded, I would say. So doctors have a higher suicide rate than the military right now. Medicine has become industrialized. There are many, many, many more administrators than clinicians. The art and the practice of medicine, as I saw it practiced by stellar clinicians with a ton of hands-on care, is being eroded by electronic medical records. And I was seeing these trends, and I couldn't escape them. Like maybe whatever it is about my brain, I couldn't ignore what I saw as the writing on the wall. And we're seeing all this stuff about physician burnout right now, but I saw it probably 10 years earlier. And what happened was I was in my third year of medicine. I was supposed to pick a specialty, and I was interested in surgery, and I was confronted with a resident who had done 12 years of cardiac surgery training only to emerge from training and realize that percutaneous interventions, which were handled by cardiologists, had been selected as the preferred therapy. And so all of these cardiac surgeons, 12 years into their like fine training, were completely out of work, and they had no hope of like they'd have to do an entirely separate surgical residency. And it wasn't just like her, it was like all across Canada. There was no jobs for them whatsoever because this technology had emerged and nobody had taken it seriously. The cardiac surgeons thought that it wasn't open. And so they were like, we'll give that to the internal medicine doctors. And then I didn't just see that there. I saw it in laparoscopic surgery and all these other things. So I was like, I need to study technology trends to figure out which specialties are going to have a job 20 years from now. And it wasn't just this, it was tissue engineering. All these different therapies were emerging. And so I started to look at technology, and I really felt split. Like, I didn't know which path to pursue. And also, I was becoming increasingly aware that, they call this in medicine, there's this metaphor they always use of, like, fishing people out of the river or going up and repairing the bridge upstream. And I became so obsessed with public health and preventative medicine and keeping people healthy rather than treating them so far downstream after they were already sick. And I felt myself being pulled in two separate directions. It was like your skis getting separated, and you can see yourself going downhill, and they're just totally separate. And I ended up getting pulled, I think, more from my desire to have an impact than anything. I wanted to make the most people healthy that I could. And so, because you can't treat end-stage diabetes more than once or twice before you're like, wow, you know, I just really want to get involved in a sugar-sweetened beverage campaign. and talk about soda pop and how it hurts the human body. So yeah, anyway, so and then the further I went down that road, in Stanford I studied preventative medicine, and you're in the hotbed of Silicon Valley and high tech, and I started to see how high tech, like Fitbits, could like totally like terraform the world and make so many people healthy all at once. And then that was just the start, and then it was just an endless stream of experimentation and projects after that.
Okay, but I mean, so sort of to wrap a little bow around it, it was effectively you were more caught up in the technology world than you were with medicine, given that medicine's a little bit slow in adopting various things.
Yeah, if you want to say it simply. But it's not simple. If you were trained in medicine, they don't just teach you something. It's like the military. They take you apart at the seams on the most fundamental level, your identity, sleep deprivation, constant criticism. You rewires who you think you are, and nobody who goes through medicine doesn't experience this. You get tired and sad and traumatized and sleep deprived, and you totally fundamentally change your identity on a core level.
I understand.
Yeah, and so to leave that is a betrayal. It's like leaving the military, and my friends who leave combat troops and the camaraderie and the identity of that, and then start again with a different life. It's the same kind of trauma. I don't know anybody who can leave medicine without feeling that they've betrayed their mentors in some way.
Okay, that's fair. But moving forward, at present, you've gone in a very different path where you're effectively not just helping individuals. Your goal is to effectively help the planet as a whole, because you've sort of gone in this climate change area. You've got your own company. You've got a whole bunch of interesting things here. So before we dive into all that, first and foremost, what's going on with climate change? Like what's the deal here? Like let's hear it from the horse's mouth. Clearly something's up. Clearly the temperature is rising. Clearly something is causing it. Like, is it all humans? Is it part humans? Like, I'm just genuinely curious for your take. What does that look like from your perspective?
Okay. Yeah. Wow. I'm going to tell you two things. So first off, I didn't stop being a healer just because I left medicine, and I was on walkabout with these five shaman watching their traditional healing just out of my own curiosity, when I picked up this project. And somehow it had everything to do with like forest fires and my other background. It just felt like my life kind of came together in this complex pattern that I didn't see coming. Climate change. Okay, so I am not, as a scientist, I am not going to get into a global warming debate. Like the objective evidence is that temperatures are heating up. As to the cause, the most likely target that we could actually fix is CO2 in the atmosphere, which we know causes greenhouse gas-like effects, or we hypothesize, and it's probably the best theory we've got. Also, it's the easiest thing to target, and the objective evidence is that the CO2 has exponentially risen ever since the Industrial Revolution. So, leaving aside why the planet is heating up, and I believe that there's good enough arguments on both sides. Maybe we're just in a heat, warming cycle, or maybe we caused it. But as you know, in a chimpanzee species, who's recently developed the ability to get past, burning sticks and into burning planes, we might as well start with the CO2 in the atmosphere, because at least we can do something about that. That's where I stand on that global warming debate. As far as climate change, sorry, go.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, I wasn't trying to draw you into a specific argument or anything. I'm just genuinely curious from your position, like where does this look like for the rest of us humans?
Yeah, no, I didn't want to get into an argument either, but I just feel like it's so important to address it. So many people are in denial about it, and I just don't see the point. It seems to have become a political or an emotional issue, and I think it really comes down to fear. Like, people are like, what can I do about this? And if you don't give people a productive outlet, they're just going to do their best to suppress the information, because that's how we survive. We live every day with a threat of injury or car accident or whatever, and we can't afford to think about it if we can't do anything about it. And I feel like climate too often ends up in that situation. But there's no debating the fact that it started to impact us in absolutely undesirable ways. like the power outages in Texas, or the desertification that we're seeing in the southern US, or the increase in forest fires, all these issues that are impacting some of the poorest people on the planet first, doesn't mean they're not going to hit us. And I feel like we have to find productive and interesting ways to deal with it, because there's no other way to live in my mind.
How do we deal with this? I mean, you said it yourself. We have to find productive and interesting. So how do we deal with this? And I don't want to be prescriptive about your answer, but I'm actually, you know, I'd like to hear it from, like, what can person A do? And then from that matter, maybe we jump up a notch and, like, what could a company do? And then maybe we jump up a notch, like, what could a country do? Right? Like what on the varying levels of locality, you know, how can we combat some of this stuff?
Well, the first thing to do is to change small habits. And I'm a huge fan of, from preventative medicine, I learned something called tiny habits. So you don't try and change all of your global signature all at once. What you do is just try to change one thing. So, I mean, if people just stop eating meat for one dinner a week, it actually has a significant impact. Small things like that, that you can change without even really noticing the difference. Just developing a taste for, like, one vegan meal that you can possibly stomach. You know, people don't have to eat meat all the time. And if they understood about the carbon signature of the meat consumption that they have, they probably wouldn't eat it nearly as much. Cycling, it's all good. Like, you just lose weight. Nothing to lose.
I don't understand the impact of the meat that I eat on carbon consumption. Is it like a cow thing, a chicken thing? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, pretty much all animal farming for meat generates a much higher carbon signature than if you just ate a plant-based diet. Cows have a really strong impact on the climate, and we eat a lot of beef without really thinking about it. The thing is, you just don't really know how much meat is in your food until you try and go vegan or something like that, and then you realize, oh my God, it's in everything I eat. And is it really necessary? No.
Okay.
Entire society is without it.
Sure. But again, from your suggestion, it seems like, you know, if you want to have an impact as a regular person, if you go one meal a week less, just one meal a week less with no meat or something like that, you could actually have a significant impact. Again, not only at a local level, but if everybody did this, it would be effectively almost on a global level, right?
Yep, and these are small changes, and they're actually just super healthy. Like, veganism has been shown, like, eating one vegan meal a week has been shown to extend your lifespan and improve your skin. Like, you don't need as much meat as you think you do. And then, you know, cycling, like, one day a week will literally, I mean, I think I lost 10 pounds once by switching to a bicycle in San Francisco from a car, and I never thought that I would lose that much weight so fast, but it just happens naturally. So these are, like, globally beneficial things you can do that are small. For me, I have a much... You know, I like to terraform things. So if I can put out an ember, that's great. But if I can start a massive backburn and put out a forest fire, I'm much more entertained. So I'm looking at bigger scale interventions.
I think we should qualify that, because I think I know what you just said, but I'm not sure we talked about that in the firefighting segment, which is a backburn is effectively where you're like intentionally setting a fire, right? To run into another fire. And thus both of them get put out. Something of this nature, correct?
Yeah, the idea is that the fire coming at you is too big to handle, so you create your own fire that works for you, and then you, like, run them into each other, which is way more fun. Like, literally the most fun I've ever had. At one point, I will tell you the story. We were in Santa Barbara, and there was a fire going downhill towards Oprah's house. And we were like, oh no, not Oprah's mansion. So we were like, we will set off this entire canyon. I think we burned like thousands of hectares. We made a fire 10 times the size of the fire that was threatening Oprah's house, and it sucked up the fire into our much bigger blaze. And it was probably the best day of my life. But I'm reformed now. Now I plant trees.
I like it. So It almost seems like you going into this climate is making up for your previous
I have some karma to resolve. Although, just being the pragmatist that I am, I realize that, like, the amount of carbon stored in the desert around Oprah's house is much less than the carbon in the Colombian Amazon. So if you have to pay up this much karma, you just want to be efficient about it. Yeah.
Okay, so you've got a company, and it's basically in the space of the carbon capture market. And the first question is, What is the carbon capture market? How does this thing work? We've all heard about it, and people are trading credits, and companies are buying this and that and the other. What's going on here? What is this? How does this work?
Well, okay, first of all, I'd like to say to all the critics, what the hell else are you going to do? Like, do you have an alternative solution? And if not, stop criticizing it. It's like the only thing we've got economically that is driving even some part of conservation or carbon capture. And basically, it's this idea that companies can pay somebody else to store carbon. And in some cases, that's totally legitimate. Like, I was working with this massive aluminum factory. I don't know if you know about aluminum, but unless people stop using it, which is great, less aluminum foil is great, you can stop doing that right now. But just aluminum in general, we're probably not going to get rid of it this century. And it puts out a shit ton of carbon. And so for an aluminum factory to stop having the massive impact that it is, you have to pay somebody else to do it. They're not in the business of carbon storage. And I think I talked to a massive international port the other day about the same thing. We're not going to get rid of international shipping tomorrow. And so for a lot of these industries, the impetus and the idea to pay somebody else to store carbon is excellent. The criticism of the carbon market is, are you actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere? And a lot of the early projects just weren't. They were somewhat fictional, like national parks saying that they weren't going to cut down their trees. So that wasn't really adding anything.
Okay, so that's not, right. And that's sort of like maybe where some of the criticism comes from. But now let's go back to, how does one store carbon? Like, what is the mechanism for this? Is it literally planting trees, watching them grow, eat the carbon, and then which they effectively store, you know, in the wood, and then they expel oxygen? I mean, what's the mechanism here?
So ironically, and we don't like to admit this, our chemical methods for taking carbon out of the atmosphere are highly ineffective and not likely to scale anytime soon. They just don't add up. The energetic economics of it don't add up. The best way to pull carbon out of the atmosphere in the parts per million that it's currently in is plants and algae. And they already have the technology. All we have to do is plant a tree. The science would say that we can never plant enough trees. There's not enough land on the planet to plant enough trees to pull enough carbon out to account for our sins, for our climate sins. And that is true, but trees aren't the only way to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. Algae will also do it. The problem is algae is very difficult to transact. If you look at international markets, blue carbon, which is algae, it's very hard to say how much carbon has been pulled into water because water is in a flux state. And then the other one is biochar, which is my personal favorite. You turn trees or plants or organic material into early coal. And it stores carbon for about 500 years, and it also provides an alternative fertilizer. It's probably the most promising method of carbon capture that we've got. But where I work, for about 25% of the world's land carbon is stored in tropical forests. And they're under extreme threat of deforestation right now. So I work on preserving tropical forests and then planting more trees in tropical forests because they grow faster, they live longer, and they store more carbon.
Okay. And then you've also had some interesting conversations, let's just say, in the particular region that you're in, given the competing business interests. Do you want to describe some of those?
Yeah, this is a little tough. Okay, so let's go to meta level. There are 2 billion people on the planet that are subsistence farmers. In other words, they grow what they eat and they live off what they grow. They don't usually have money or any kind of wealth, but what they do have is land. And these people tend to live in the equator. About 1 billion of them live in tropical forests. So if you look at where carbon matters on land that you can actually control, it's in this band at the equator. And almost every single country that covers this tropical forest is completely weakened. In other words, the Congo, the Colombian Amazon, the Brazilian Amazon. These are areas that have, they're like 80% of the protected land is with indigenous groups. They don't really have strong central governments, and there's a ton of corruption, and the people are not well served. They don't have a digital identity. They don't have a banking system. These are a totally different population, and nobody really seems to care about them on economic levels. For the first time, perhaps, in the history of the world, these people, instead of trying to sell mangoes at the local market, they actually have a valuable product in their backyard. So they don't have to transport their goods and be connected to an international system in order to do something of economic worth. the question is, how do you transact with them at all? And where I work is in the Colombian Amazon. I work in former FARC territory. The only viable economy here for the last 20 years has been growing cocaine. And like heroin, cocaine is grown in small plots in the jungle, in remote areas, by small farmers, by subsistence farmers. And we're very careful never to talk about like competing with cocaine as an economy. I'm just not interested at all. But what I'd like to do is offer an alternative economy in this region, which is planting trees instead, or conserving your jungle, or preserving biodiversity.
Right. And so basically, when we're talking about this carbon capture, it's effectively forests that are at risk of being cut down for, and then basically just saying there's actually ways that you can make money and literally not cut this down, promote biodiversity, do subsistence farming, etc. And like there is an alternative for this that's not only good for you, as in like you can make money, you can eat, you can live the way you want to live, but on top of that, like you are doing your part for sort of the global, you know, the global community of humanity.
It's a totally underrecognized workforce. Like, I don't know why nobody cares about subsistence farmers. It's 2 billion people, and they're some of the hardest working, most pragmatic people on earth. Yes, they might not be easy to reach as an economic market, but if you put them to work in carbon storage, it's some of the most cheapest and most effective labor force you could ever have. And also some of the most intelligent. I work with small farmers every day, and you cannot live like this in the jungle off your own labor without being an incredibly pragmatic, honest, hardworking person. I'd much rather do business with a small farmer than the average North American, to be honest. They're great business partners.
So let's talk about your company. What do we got going on there? So because basically we've been sort of leading up to this, now that we sort of understand like what's the impact that climate change is having, you know, what are the ways that we can sort of attempt to stop this? And then beyond that, you know, this labor force of folks, what's your company got going on?
Well, we're like a forest fire in reverse. And it's
actually, do you want to say the name of your company? And then,
So Sabimbo was a name that my, I have a consulting company for what I call delinquent savants, high IQ people who don't really follow the rules. We're like the anti-McKinsey. We've been working on hard scientific and social problems ever since I left medicine. So we started off tackling like medical research for Baidu and Stanford and all these different universities who were producing, I would say, conformist intellects who weren't coming up with novel observations. So they would hire us to come up with their original research, and then we would get paid and we would just go on to the next gig. That was where we started. And then this was the five Colombian Titans came to us and they said, why aren't we getting paid for conservation? And we were like, I don't know, we'll look into it, we'll see, we'll figure it out. And then we hacked it and we're like, oh my God, 90% of these carbon markets were going to brokers. Like all the money was getting like lost on the trading floor in New York and Chicago. And these guys who actually matter, the ones who really could move the dial, were getting $0 because the money was going through the UN to corrupt governments. It would never penetrate to the jungle. There was no economic incentives to stop deforestation. So this was just a big experiment. We were like, what if we paid these guys directly? And these three things had changed. Like international banking had evolved to the point where I could actually pay a small farmer directly into a bank account. I did a couple of trials here in the Amazon and I was like, wow, I can pay you $5 and it doesn't cost me that much. So we realized we could pay them direct, and that took out all of the corruption and endemic problems working in these regions. And then they started to get cell phones. So I was traveling around and I was like, wow, all five of these medicine doctors have a cell phone. So I could like drop an app on their phone to monitor forests. And then the satellite monitoring was up and I was like, wow, this is actually viable. We could actually work with this population where they live in their context. And then we just, I don't know, I guess I got mad. Like the people making the money from the carbon markets were these big multinational logging corporations who were the major threat to the forest. And then these tiny little small farmers, there's a billion of them, and they're not getting a cent, and they each own about 100 hectares of rainforest. And it costs so little to incentivize them. And they're so happy and they work so hard. And I was like, why not?
Okay, I dig it. It sounds like you have a pretty strong passion for this. So in that particular sense, how do you monitor this? I guess you sort of mentioned that I guess it's there's a lot of satellite. Are people starting to work with drones and whatnot? And how does that work?
Yeah, we've been experimenting with drones. We have to get $80,000 for a drone that will be accepted by the carbon markets. One thing that drives me nuts about the carbon markets right now is they're under so much constant criticism. They just keep making the scientific requirements harder and harder, and it just gets harder and more impossible for somebody who actually lives on the jungle to participate in the market and get any money out of it. You have to be Shell and pay a panel of scientists to do your paperwork to get any revenue from it. So. In our case, we give the farmers 20% of what we make. We take 80%. We pay a team of scientists to certify their carbon, and then we're just radically focused on scaling. So we've doubled in size in the last 3 months, actually. And it's just farmers keep pouring in the door. I made a little Apple store for small farmers. It looks like an Apple store, like almost exactly. Only it's got like, you know, crude wooden benches and pictures of parrots on the wall, and they come in and they sign up their land. We help them get land rights, and each of them brings a small portion, but as a group, as a collective. Like you bring one small farmer, you make him happy, you give him his $5, and then they get about $100 a month for their micropayment. They'll bring 10 more small farmers. It's actual viral growth. It's crazy, and it's all word of mouth.
Well, that's tremendous. And basically for each one of those, it's effectively protected. It's now legally protected land in the Colombian rainforest, correct?
Yeah. And they monitor. So we do three things. We do reforestation. So they'll plant trees. We ask them to plant a fruit tree, and they sell local superfoods. So we're looking at like distribution channels for that. And then they monitor the animal species in their backyard, and we sell biodiversity credits. So if they can prove that their plantation has a sentinel species, so we'll monitor like jaguars as a metric of all the other species underneath it. If you have a jaguar on your land, then likely the other species are intact. We also monitor a bird and a couple other rare species. And then, so they get biodiversity credits if they can get the animals to come back in. And then we also do conserved jungle. So depending on how long it takes for the forest to regrow. This is not North America. This is not California. We can grow a tropical forest to full standing height in 6 years. It's addictive.
Six years?
This jungle is insane, and it's alive. Like, I've worked in other Latin American countries where the jungle is dead. And then you have to like go through these labor intensive reconstructive efforts. But for us, if we just take the cows off the land, it grows back to full standing height. And that's so much. It's about 900 tons of carbon per hectare.
That's incredible. I mean, I was thinking like 6 decades, it would end up coming back, but you're talking about 6 years for like full reharmonization.
Yeah. It's not the same as native jungle. And so if you actually care about forest restoration, you'll do anything to preserve native jungle, because a native jungle here has 3,000 different species. 30 of our best cancer drugs came from this area. People I know who research novel experimental therapies know about 2,000 medicinal plants in Ecuador. The Taitas that I work with have 5,000 in their formulary. And this is 5,000-year-old medicinal knowledge that Europeans have never been in contact with.
What kind of cancer drugs are coming out of there?
30 of our best cancer drugs were developed from the Amazon. Yeah. The biological information that is here, that not only hereditary in the indigenous population, but also just like completely underexplored. It is a global treasure, the Amazon is, and the people in it are as well a global treasure, and we just have not valued it. One of the things that interests me the most is this is like an alternative history. Like, we say that this region is owned by Colombia, but this has been independent indigenous land for 5,000 years. Since long before the Spanish conquistadors. Like, the reason that the government is not so strong here is because this land is still owned by indigenous peoples, and it follows their rules, and that's why there's intact forests. This is what North America would have been like if we hadn't had smallpox on our side.
Okay. Well, that's some. It's a powerful narrative. So
yeah.
Not to get away from that for a second, but you mentioned these cancer drugs are in there. So
yeah.
Rabbit hole with me for a second here. So I know you and I have spoken offline about this many, many times, but so cancer is effectively uncontrolled growth of damaged cells. What are these drugs coming out of the Amazon doing? They're able to regulate the growth, repair the cells, identify the, I mean, like, how does that work?
Yeah, most cancer drugs, it depends on the kind of cancer, but most of our cancer drugs will kill cells in different ways, and they'll kill a lot of them. Like, if you talk to a Western doctor, they'll always tell you that the most effective medicine is the most deadly. So like prednisone is a steroid, and it's deadly if you don't need it, but if you do need it, it's life-saving. And so the same thing goes for cancer drugs. Some cancer drugs will trigger the immune system to help control cancers, but a lot of them are just like incredibly toxic. And because cancer cells, usually a good cancer drug will kill a cell that is rapidly mutating, and cancer cells tend to have their natural regulatory mechanisms disrupted. And so if you can kill cells that are growing fast, usually that's why you lose hair, because hair grows fast. But also you'll end up killing more cancer cells than hair cells, if that makes any sense.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's brutal. In my opinion, it's life-saving, and thank God we have it, but it's a little bit brutal. You're effectively saying, let's figure out how much poison we can give you such that it kills the cancer before it kills you, right?
It's like the Agent Orange of drugs. It kills everything. Like, a good cancer drug tends to kill everything. And if you're lucky, it'll kill your cancer before it kills off the rest of your healthy body. But that's why chemotherapy sucks so bad.
Yeah. What's the reason we can't have a targeted drug? I mean, not to go back and forth, but so I remember I think it was 91 or 92, we were basically having this conversation when I was in grade school, effectively talking about HIV, AIDS, and it being this really bizarre. And again, I didn't understand I still barely understand this stuff, but they were basically talking about being this retrovirus that attacks, I believe it's T cells, right?
Helper T cells.
And it goes, sorry?
There's two kinds of T cells. Like, T cells kill your cells when they're acting out of line. And that's cytotoxic T cells. So they'll kill your cells. It's like the soldiers. And helper T cells are like the generals. And HIV is brutal because it attacks the general, not the soldiers.
Okay. And so, but the reason that I thought about this is, you know, basically it could identify this one type of cell that it literally just infects. And the weird part is you don't actually die from it. You just have no immune system left. So then you die from a cold or pneumonia or anything else.
Yeah.
The reason that I always was thinking about that is at the same time they were talking about effectively the beginnings of genetic engineering. Again, this is, you know, early 90s. And so I was always thinking to myself, what's the reason we can't take this retrovirus? Because I didn't know that there were a lot of those. But what's the reason we can't take this thing, genetically engineer it so that it thinks damaged cells are these T cells that it normally goes after, and that way you just infect them with this on purpose, and then it nukes cancer. Like, that's the whole point. Like, you've infected yourself with a virus. Apparently now they're doing that. That's like it's like retroviral cancer treatment. It's almost like, I would think of it almost like a smart bomb, right? It's very specifically targeting these things. Why can't we get there?
Well, cancer is an unregulated cell. So I always think of it like in a society, it's like a Unabomber that takes over and starts cloning itself. And so cancer is very de-differentiated, and it'll start to mutate really, really fast. And usually what happens is it loses autoregulation capacity. And so the cells that it produces are often undifferentiated, they're rapidly growing, and synthesizing a specific drug that will kill that cell in particular. First off, you're going to end up with cell lines that are totally, you might have one cell line for the cancer, but you might have like four or five that start to emerge out of it. It's such a chaotic process, if you think about it.
So I guess the question is, again, very hypothetical. Let's just say I have unlimited access to money. I have literally infinity money.
Yeah.
Is there not a way that I could just basically hire scientists and say, this is the type of cancer, go pull whatever it is that you need to pull out of wherever the tumors are or wherever it is in the body, go pull that, figure out what the strains are, and literally find me a smart bomb, develop it now, and just absolutely nuke this. Again, with unlimited resources, is that possible?
I don't think it's possible for a lot of cancers, because cancer doesn't just kill you by replicating itself. It also kills you by disrupting natural structures.
Okay.
So let's say you go in there, the cancer will invade natural parts of the body, and it will disrupt function. So like, for instance, you have a cancer in the brain and it's taking over brain tissue. You can't just go out there in there and get rid of the cancer because you've also lost natural structures. The word cancer comes from the word for crab, and it's for the way that it grows on the body. Like it crawls into the body the way a crab crawls. And if you've ever held it in your hand, you have an intense kinesthetic sense for how invasive it is, I guess is the best way to describe it. So okay. I think what's the purpose of cancer therapy? Like, is it the purpose to live forever? Because that's never going to happen. The longer that you live, the more that the body, the more that your cell, the cells in your body have replicated themselves. They're not the cells you started with. They're like a copy of the cells that you started with. And if you live for 100 years, then it's your body has copied itself 100 times. So you aren't just necessarily going to have one cancer. Maybe you're going to have two. Like one might be more advanced than the other. So I think when you look at cancer therapy, you have to look at the reason for it. Is it because somebody was born with a genetic code deleted and it caused them to have cancer in infancy? Like sometimes you see kids with retinal cancer from birth, and then there's all kinds of reasons to go in there and try and treat that. But if it's somebody in their 80s whose heart's wearing out and their liver's wearing out and they're also having cancer, then a lot of those people will choose not to do anything because...
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. I didn't want to sidetrack too much. I was just very, you know, very going from the cancer drugs in the Amazon, it just, again, it seems like we have this precious resource down there that can treat one of, arguably, the biggest plague that humanity is facing at present.
Well, and, I mean, cancer, Parkinson's, like, we'll be hiking around the jungle and the shaman will look over and be like, oh, that drug treats Parkinson's. And I'll just be like, mind blown. Like, yeah, no, it's not uncommon. They'll be like, oh, that one cures diabetes. And I'm just like, oh, shit. Like, we can't even begin to study this stuff until we can at least value this region. I'm just going to go back 200 years. 200 years ago, the indigenous groups here told some Spaniards, oh, by the way, that tree produces rubber. And the next thing they know, they were colonized in Putumayo by the slave trade for the rubber trees. And if you read the historical accounts of how they treated the locals, this is for rubber. This isn't for a cancer drug. This is just for like something they didn't think of as that valuable. Why in the heck would they share their knowledge? And what have we done to make it possible for them to share their knowledge in a way that our businesses can do business with them? Like, people here don't believe in individual ownership of collective resources. They own land collectively. If somebody has a house and their brother has a house, then when the brother needs the house, the brother lives in the house. And when the other brother needs the house, he moves in. And they just move around houses like that. Like, we don't even know how to do business with these groups. So why should they share their institutionalized knowledge that they use for healing with an economic engine which doesn't respect any of their most fundamental beliefs?
That's fair. I would agree with you that Western society is very, very much based around individualism, which produces some really interesting results. But at the same time, there are distinct drawbacks. But so what you're sort of bringing up is, it seems like there's maybe a little bit of a cultural barrier for us to even understand how to interact with these folks, to be able to bring their knowledge and what they know to be true to bear. I mean, you know, the only reason I bring this up is just recently we've been doing, I believe it's ketamine, MDMA, and psilocybin trials for people who've had trauma or they've, you know, PTSD or a number of different things. And those trials are just starting now. Whereas I believe in the Amazon, this is, I mean, especially with ayahuasca and whatnot, this is stuff that they've known for quite some time.
Yeah, my medicine doctors do. The 5 Titas I work for, they do Yahe, which is a little bit stronger version of ayahuasca that they've had traditionally in the Colombian Amazon. And they consider it, they treats addiction, they use it to treat trauma, it treats you being an asshole. Like, it does a lot of things. And they consider it like a universal healing form. It'll detox the body. You know, it's like an ancient preventative medicine. If you're being a jerk and beating your wife, one dose of Yahe and you kind of figure it out. Stop being a bully. Like, it's beautiful in its own way. And I think that so many of our paradigms are around the concept of treating downstream disease like cancer. When if we just treated the desire to eat unhealthy foods, which is kind of what they do here.
I can't remember. There's definitely some truth to what you've said. I can't remember who said it, but I believe the quote is something like, "Beware of easily obtained knowledge," something of this nature.
Jordan Peterson, one of my favorites. I know as a feminist I'm not supposed to love him, but I adore Jordan Peterson.
I'm not sure if he's the first person who said it, but I know he said it before.
Yeah, he said, I think it's from Jung, and I think, I remember the quote, and I wish I could give it verbatim, but it was something like, beware of the knowledge of the gods. And I will say that I do think, so, you know, I had a tough background, and I did some therapy when I was in my 20s and 30s. And Yahe is like therapy on steroids. So like you kind of like interface with the subconscious directly and you can face a lot of your demons, but you still have to do the work afterwards. And so it's not like a shortcut in any means. Like anybody who does it will still have to process it and integrate it into their lives. It's just a much faster therapy. The therapists that I know love psychedelics because they're like, oh my God, what would take me 10 years with somebody, it will take me like a week. I still have to deal with insights, but...
I think maybe some of the stereotypes with this stuff basically comes from people sort of abusing those psychedelics in the West, you know, literally just as a way to, you know, escape reality, get high, whatever it is, have a good time, whatever you're trying to do. Yeah. And what we're talking about in sort of your sense, and again, the same sense is in the trials that they're doing now with the MDMA, the ketamine and psilocybin. And like you were saying with Yahe, ayahuasca, it seems like it's almost a side effect that it gets you high. It's actually not the purpose. The purpose is sort of to really, like, this is the beginning of a journey, but like you're not done once it wears off. Like there are things that need to occur and there's a process that happens. And I think that's sort of the way we're sort of going off the rails in the West, not understanding these things, right?
Yeah, it's not a vacation. It's your actual life. The purpose isn't to go there, it's to bring there here and reintegrating it into your life and applying it. There are two kinds of ignorance. You know, one is that I don't know things. Like, I personally am a terrible rollerblader, and I'm sure that I have lots to learn about rollerblading, and I'm ignorant of rollerblading. The other kind of ignorance is when you think you know something that you don't. I think I'm not a privileged person, even though I grew up white and then went to medical school in the US. That's a different kind of ignorance. And the Yahe and psychedelics fix the second type of ignorance. It's the one where you think you know who you are and where you're at in the world and what's right and what's wrong, and you don't. And what it does is it brings you into stark confrontation with your subconscious, which is unforgiving and truthful, and you cannot forget it. And anybody who's spent any time with the subconscious trying to reset it through hypnosis or expanding their intellectual cognitive horizons or educating themselves or anything, anybody who's ever realized when they were being a shithead and they didn't know it, knows how painful it can be, and so rewarding. There's no better exploration or no better use of time on the planet than to explore the things that we thought we knew and didn't.
There's a lot of truth there. There's more than a lot of truth there. That might be truth, just flat out. I want to go back a little bit towards sort of the what we were talking about a little bit earlier in terms of the carbon markets, just because you mentioned that, like, it's very difficult to get involved in this. And obviously, like, that's not good for a number of different reasons, because, you know, if it takes someone with the resources of Shell or Exxon to try and get into this. Not that they shouldn't be in it. I'm fine that they're in it. That's good. They're trying to offset some of the stuff. But it seems like there should be other people to get in it. And then beyond that, I know you and I have had some offline conversations and sort of exploring the market itself, where it's like, yeah, you have to get certified in this very particular way. And these people... like there's not multiple certification bodies, as I understand it. So again, you end up with this sort of like this monopoly of certification, which ends up being sort of a choke point for the market itself. Can we walk through that a little bit?
Yeah, the worst thing about the certification bodies right now, well, first off, you're dealing with nature. You're measuring plants and algae, and nature is inherently chaotic. And people don't like that. They want their nature to be like a pile of bricks where you can stack it on top of each other instead of a rainforest where it just everything is complex. Our science is not well designed to study complexity theory. Like the weather is complex. The human body is complex. This is complexity, and you have to measure it or quantify it in some way. So the markets are all standardized around this concept of 1 ton of carbon, like storing 1 ton of carbon for 30 to 100 years. Is kind of the accepted norm. And then the problem thing comes into how do you prove that you did that? And these certifying bodies have emerged, and it's kind of a necessary evil where, like, you need some kind of universal standard, and then everybody hates the standard, and then the standard, currently the international, like, standards are sustained cert, gold standard, and FARA. And then I would argue that Sierra Carbono is an emerging standard. These are, like, the ones people like. The problem with these certifying bodies is they take their money from the projects. So you have to pay the certifying body off before you can go to sell your product. And the more they certify you, the more you have to pay them. So it's totally perverse incentives. They don't benefit from you getting your carbon tons out into the market. And then the external criticism in the market has incentivized corporations. It's easier to pay a publicity department like Salesforce did to say that you're going green than to actually buy the tons of carbon to offset your signature like Microsoft and Stripe have done. So Microsoft and Stripe are leading the market. They have very little carbon to offset, so they can afford to overpay for good credits. But so many companies are just doing lip service, and the more they criticize the markets, the cheaper it is for them to just say, well, that gives me an excuse not to buy carbon and not to put money into this.
Sure, sure. How do we fix that? I mean, I guess that's the easiest way to...
It's going to get regulated.
So regulation on, you know, who? The EPA? Is it, you know, I don't know. Would you go WHO for this? Like, seriously, it's a health issue. So, like, where would you go?
So I think the right place to go, so it's already coming. So there's this thing called the Paris Accords. So, like, I think it's 190 countries got together, and they all said that they were going to lower global temperatures by 2030. The problem with that is it's supposed to be legally binding, but there's really no penalty if you don't do it. So that said, all the nations went back and ratified it in their home countries. So everybody's committed to this, even if it's just lip service. And then that trickles down. So government has about a 5-year horizon. Industry has about a 10-year horizon, and insurance has a 15-year horizon. So insurance companies like Lloyd's of London are driving the market in a lot of ways because they'll refuse to insure a company that hasn't looked into its climate signature. And then the SEC is following suit. So now companies in the SEC have to report their carbon emissions. The two areas of the world that are the most progressed on this is the airline industry, where airlines by law have to offset a certain amount of their emissions. And then California, which goes after companies. But the problem with California is you have to like store your carbon in California, which is very stupid. If you look at the if you're going to plant trees in California, where forest fires are a constant threat and trees don't grow as fast, it just doesn't make as much sense. So there's something called the tropical forest standard where companies are saying, can't we store carbon somewhere else? It's air, it travels.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, I would imagine California is doing that specifically because they really don't have jurisdiction outside of basically California land, right?
Well, they have jurisdiction over California companies.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right. And so I hear what you're saying. It's like, right, we may have to abide by this law, but like, what's the reason we have to put it in this particular state? It seems like that's, you know, sort of suboptimal when there's a million other places that are apparently faster to grow. The land's probably cheaper, among other things, right?
Yeah, it's air. Like, I mean, I think the biggest problem with the international carbon market to date is the assumption that all carbon storage regions in the world are created equal. They haven't been. If you look at the Earth as an organism, so biogeochemistry is the combination of all three disciplines, and it looks at the Earth as an organism. And in this case, the best place to store carbon is at the equator.
Okay. And so what? How does your company feed into this? I mean, basically, do you have to get your trees certified and the various hectares that you've got? I mean, does one
it's
of the representatives have to come, or can you maybe send sat pictures, or what does that look like?
So we have to go out and measure trees with a tape measure, because that's where the industry is at, and that's what they want. So we go out and measure trees with a tape measure, and then we extrapolate that to the area. We're writing a 200-page document right now in an entirely different industry using what I would describe as some of the world's worst scientific writing, but it's the industry norm. It looks more like a military grant than any kind of science paper I've ever seen. The science is just that I am not a fan of the certification standard as it currently stands. I think it's not efficient, it's not scalable, and it's not going to survive the market. As market forces drive more and more people to want to transact on this, we're going to see a different standard emerging. But it's where the standard is at, and we work for our small farmers. So we'll tick whatever box we need to do to get them onto the market. I think we're the only company I know about who's trying to both deal work with small farmers and go through the main certification pipeline.
Right.
And it is backbreaking labor, I'll be honest.
Well, on behalf of all of humanity, thanks for doing it for us. Honestly, Drea, if I was going to put someone in charge of this, it would probably be you anyway. So I'm glad you're at the forefront. So as we're walking down this path of sort of climate change, what you mentioned at the beginning was there's not enough land to plant the trees that we would need to offset this stuff. What do we do? Like, what does the solution look like?
Okay, so first off, you have to stop deforestation. There's literally nothing more important right now. It's like you're in a tiny little lifeboat and you got a leak in the boat and you stop bailing. Like, you need to bail the water and close the holes in the boat. That's all there is to it. And the forests are the only thing bailing us out right now. And they're at a tipping point. If we can't stop the deforestation in the Amazon, there's local rainfall cycles. And what happens is you cut enough trees down and they stop sucking the water and creating the local rainfall. The forest dries out, it burns, and then it emits more carbon than we ever want to imagine. So it makes the problem infinitely worse. There's really nothing more important right now in terms of our little global lifeboat than stopping the deforestation of primary forest. In the Amazon in particular, 25% of the world's carbon stored here.
So we stop deforestation. That's the first thing. I'm guessing the second thing is use cleaner energy or something of this nature.
Planting trees is great. Like, why not plant a tree? It doesn't cost that much. And instantly the tree starts going to work for you. So now you've got more people bailing out of the lifeboat. And then you got to plug the holes, like just simple stuff like switching to electric cars. I talked to a major freight company in the U.S. They have tested their fleet, their gas fleet, and it's equally energy efficient for them to use an electric vehicle fleet right now for their major transportation and shipping. So there is no reason why not to switch to electric cars anymore. Economically, it's the same. So stuff like that, we can stop the holes in the boat as well. And it's going to take us a long time to bail out.
Which is fair. But as far as electric cars, again, there are other issues there, right? Like the rare earth minerals being pulled out of the Congo, child slave labor. I mean, there's still some issues there. But even beyond that, when you're plugging in your car, though, I mean, unless you know that for a fact that you're getting your stuff from a renewable energy source, aren't you really just transferring from the pump to the power station, I guess, as far as carbon?
Yeah, this one's a debate. During my long and illustrious semi-scientific career, I did work for a while on nuclear power, looking at new nuclear power designs that are getting approved in the U.S. TerraPower and NuScale are some of them. As a doctor, you like cancer drugs. Sometimes you kill cells and you don't want to. I don't think we have a lot of alternative resources for a base power grid other than nuclear power right now. And I think we have to move on it fast. Like, China's building a ton of nuclear power plants because it's really the only alternative we've got. We don't know how to get rid of nuclear waste well. There are bacteria that will degrade it. And I think our best hope for learning how to clean up nuclear waste is probably in the bacterial research.
Not strapping it to some giant rocket and having Elon shoot it into the sun. That's not an option.
Elon obviously doesn't think much about space junk. But everybody I know is studying space junk just says we're kicking the can down the road and potentially making our lives, future lives, much worse if we don't start thinking about that too. It's not like you can just go out into space and not worry about garbage. We have to get better at garbage as a species.
That's fair. And figure out how we can basically break these things down naturally, correct?
Yeah, I think we have to start making more biodegradable and plant-based substances. Anybody who's ever seen the cool little plastic spoons that are plant-based, it's like, wow, we figured that out and we made it. And then our single-use plastics go away. I mean, we can. We are a smart species. We can evolve. I just have such an optimism about the human race. How far we've come.
I'll be honest with you here. in my opinion, this is very refreshing to my ears. And the specific reason is a lot of times when I hear people talk about this, and I think that our environment and our climate is a very important subject, and I think it should be paid attention to, and I do think we need to do things. But every time I hear doomsayers and just saying everything's going to hell unless we stop everything tomorrow, every time I hear that, I'm going, but why even say something like that? Like, can't we just start with some solutions and then build and build and build and build? And it seems like that's what you're saying. Like, there are ways out of this, and I'm an optimist like you are. I think human beings are an incredibly smart species. I believe that we can find a way out of this. We created the problem. I'm positive we can clean it up, or at least part of the problem for, you know, whatever side of the debate you're on. At least, you know, some of it's our issue. And even if it's not, who cares? We still need to address this issue, right?
Yeah, we extended our lifespan by 30 years by cleaning up our drinking water. Like, it wasn't
impressive.
That complicated. Yeah, if you look at the reason that the human lifespan is longer, it's for public health things. So we cleaned up our drinking water. We figured out how to manage our sewage. Like, we just have no excuse not to try. I just don't think, you know, we have intelligence. We have the ability. We have the will. We know about habit change. We can change. And this whole, like, I'm just going to sit in a funk and complain about everybody else doesn't get anywhere. I'm a David Brin fan. He's the futurist. And if you read his books, they're really well researched. I think he knows a lot about emerging science, and he's an optimist like I am. Like, I just don't think, I think pessimism is just an excuse not to do anything. And then, you know, I look at things like Yahe that totally change the cognitive capacity and self-regulatory ability of a human species. We have things like meditation, yoga, and psychedelics that dramatically change our ability to act as holistic, responsible, integrated human beings. So we don't have the option. I think we have technologies that we can use to change our behaviors, and we need to be more conscious and radical about using them. We don't have the option to act like a chimpanzee species anymore. We aren't, and we will never survive if we keep doing that.
Okay.
It's not about running away to the stars.
All right. So, Drea, if you could manifest a technology into existence, like you're just waving a wand and it's there tomorrow, obviously having to do with, I don't know, one of your many fields, what would that be? What technology would you like to see exist tomorrow?
Cold fusion.
Why cold fusion?
It's clean, puts out water as a side effect, and it would totally radically completely turn the world economy on its head, and I think that'd be entertaining.
You think we would stop climate change, not necessarily in its tracks, but like grind it to extraordinarily slow if just tomorrow there was cold fusion out there?
Yeah, it'd be so cool. I think what we'd see is just I really came to understand this when I was working in the Peruvian Amazon. I'm like far upriver, outside of cell service. And I'm realizing that the only economy that matters is gas to get up and down the river and electricity or internet. Those are the only things that matter. And that's the only thing that matters in the entire world economy right now. So, like, if you look at what drives, like, the way people move, or like an anthill, what keeps the ants buzzing around, energy is a really important thing, and we can't ignore it. Money is just a proxy for it. And so if we had clean energy, and we do, we have good solar power, but it's not amazing. Nuclear power is okay, but it puts out waste. If we could do cold fusion, it'd be so cool.
Yeah, that's a good one. Leon and I actually spoke about that on the podcast. That wasn't the technology he manifested, but we spoke about that. It's sort of the difference between the hot fusion and cold fusion, et cetera. Yeah, it was one of the interesting topics we went through. But it's interesting that you would pick that basically this waste-free, completely not, I don't think there's anything that's 100% efficient, but like unbelievably efficient power source that's just basically made from magic rocks, or, you know, however it is that we end up getting the cold fusion to work would be pretty incredible.
The question is, would we have the self-restraint not to immediately turn it into some kind of war or weapon?
I mean, the answer is no. Clearly, it's going to be weaponized at some point. I think that's just who we are as a species. At
least
that's my
answer. We're a lot
more
peaceful than we used to be as a species.
That's true. We actually, as strange as it sounds, I do believe we've actually gotten smarter and more peaceful as a species. But again, you know, you hear about some crazy stuff that happens every other day. But cold fusion's a good one. Anything else? I'll give you a second shot at the question just in case you want to manifest one more thing.
Wow.
Just curious.
I mean, I'm a doctor, so I'd love to see the ability to regenerate.
Like true cellular regeneration?
Well, I see it in yoga. If people practice yoga, their whole body, like they age in reverse, they lose weight, their body becomes more flexible. It's beautiful. I'm not sure that we don't have that ability, but it'd be really nice to be able to control it a little bit more. I just hate seeing people suffer.
I understand. Okay. Drea, where can people find you online? Like what's your presence? It's obviously business website, Twitter. Where do you want people to find you online?
Okay. Well, if you love me, follow us on Savimbo on any channel, because it's all about our small farmers, and you'll get to see Johnny's Jaguar's furry ass and our sexy trees.
Do you want to spell that?
Savimbo, Savimbo.
And, excellent. And where else?
You can find me online, but I don't recommend it. Like I'm Drea Burbank on any channel or Google, and so you will find an endless array of my opinionated bullshit. But I you will be highly entertained. I think somebody went down the rabbit hole a few weeks ago. They're like, my friend called me and she said she Googled your name and she spent 4 hours laughing her ass off. I don't know if it was at me or with me, but yeah. If you want to hear my opinionated stuff on medicine, I think I had an article a while out. It said why doctors are getting their asses kicked by technology. That was wildly popular on Medium and netted me 97 cents. So I'm officially a paid writer now.
Okay. You want to give us maybe the highlights from that article before we wrap up? I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I said the doctors deserve to get their asses kicked by technology because they've roundly rejected it instead of considering it their professional responsibility. And I thought doctors would be mad, but 67,000 of them read it and then they all tried to write me. So there's hope for the profession. I think that doctors might be masochists, but they're always willing to listen to constructive criticism.
Okay. Okay, unless they're neurosurgeons, in which case they're probably sadists.
I love neurosurgeons. No, not sadists, sociopaths, but very good at their job.
Got it.
Yeah. I would be way too empathic to be good at neurosurgery. I very much respect them.
Good. Outstanding. Drea, thanks so much for coming on board. This has been amazing. I really appreciate your time. Folks, we have been standing on the shoulders of giants with Dr. Drea Burbank, and I'm David Mackay. Thank you.
Thank you.